It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
Your behavior just hasn't been very oozy.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have two more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me!
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Halloween edition of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, October 30th, 2022.
There we go, that's better. Had to clear my throat a little bit there. I wasn't sounding like myself. Oh, this is my favorite time of year, and I never have enough time to watch all the movies I want to watch, but we'll definitely make some time for some Halloween movies tonight. But before we do any of that, I finally have actual developments to talk about on CM Punk and the Elite and Larry the Dog. Larry the Dog has entered the chat. 7 weeks later, Larry decided to leak his side of the story. Tony Khan takes issue with Eric Bischoff. Triple H is reportedly doing away with the most unnecessary of all the WWE pay-per-views. We know where the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view is going to be taking place, somewhere that has not had a pay-per-view in almost 15 years. And I've got the perfect scenario for the main event that night. I'm going to map it out for you. I've got Crown Jewel predictions. Billy Corgan would love to work with WWE or AEW in one very specific area. I'm sure he would. Lots to discuss. Plus, this week's NXT, we got the latest Tales from the Territories recap. Your mailbag questions. You guys have been keeping the mailman working overtime this week. But first, I have got some breaking news. I always love it when news breaks early enough on a Sunday for me to actually cover it. Usually this stuff happens after I push the show out. Shinsuke Nakamura, who just returned to SmackDown on Friday for the first time in a few months, is heading to Pro Wrestling Noah to wrestle the Great Muta at their New Year 2023 event on January 1st at Budokan Hall. Muta is in the middle of his retirement tour, which ends in February at the Tokyo Dome. He's going to be wrestling as Keiji Muto that night, but his final appearance as the Great Muta will be on January 22nd. He's going to be teaming with Sting. So the stars are coming out for the Great Muta here before he hangs it up. That tells you everything you need to know about what a legend this man is. He gets to wrestle a WWE star and tag with an AEW star, all in the same month. Nakamura has not wrestled for Noah since 2013. And then, of course, he went on to have that great run with New Japan. But this is not unheard of for WWE to allow such a thing. It's not the first time something like this has happened. Back in 2018, it was Triple H who made the deal for Kenta to return to Noah to wrestle Naomichi Marufuji on his 20th anniversary show, although he had to do it under his NXT name. He had to wrestle as Hideo Itami. But it has happened before. Some people still think Vince McMahon let Chris Jericho work the Tokyo Dome against Kenny Omega. He didn't. Jericho was not under contract with WWE at that point, and he had already made the deal when he asked Vince McMahon for his blessing. That was purely done out of respect. He did not need Vince McMahon's permission to do the match. He just wanted to reach out to him and make sure that he was okay with it. But you never hear of WWE allowing a main roster talent to do something like this. That's kind of unheard of. So you know they want something in return. My guess is that Muta is going to be going into the Hall of Fame next year. And the timing would be perfect. The timing makes all the sense in the world with him retiring and him being such a legend in the industry. To put him into the Hall of Fame makes total sense. Now, I know he never worked a match for WWE before, but they own all that footage of him from his days in WCW. It would not be very hard for them to put some highlights together of his career. So I think this whole thing is very cool. It's very cool when we see companies cooperating and working with each other like this. I'd like to see more of this. And Nakamura going back to Japan on New Year. Well, he won't have to worry about day one because there is no day one this year. There is no day one pay-per-view, so I guess they don't have to worry about that. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so. TheSolemnMonster.com. If you look at the very top of the page, you'll see the PayPal link is the very first thing you see. It's entirely up to you, but you can click that. It will take you to the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I thank you, everybody who has supported the show, and in some cases for a lot more than 10 bucks. I want to say thank you to Deathblow, David Floyd, who is off in St. Martin. He is celebrating his 31st birthday. So I want to say happy birthday to David. Enjoy it for me. I have not been to a warm climate in a few years. James Hollywood Herrera. And to answer your question, the costume is to be determined. I don't know yet what I might dress up as on the stream tomorrow night. I guess you'll just have to tune in to find out. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Paul, you are the man. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Big B, Brian Pissarra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Killshot, Keith Hart, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, The Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelotes, Caleb Showtime, Lindley Shin, Super Kick Akuma. How about the Dirty from the 530? Gabriel Sanchez, thank you all. I very much appreciate it. And I also want to thank BetterHelp for sponsoring this week's episode. You're going to hear me talk about them a little bit later. I got a very nice message from Rob this week. He knows who he is. He lost a close family member earlier this year. He started BetterHelp about a month ago and has been coming along slowly. I'm very happy that you're finding it useful, though. Very happy to hear that. Just keep at it. So let's get things started here on this 780th episode. House of Glory last night put on a great show, Exodus, from La Boom Nightclub in Queens, New York, which is a very cool venue for a wrestling show. Actually, my first time there. Cool setting for a show, especially we had all kinds of Halloween decorations up, giant skeletons and skulls everywhere. So it was very interesting, but I was very proud to be on the call with JD from New York and Dr. Hillary P. Wisdom for the main event of Shingo Takagi from New Japan Pro Wrestling coming in to take on Low Ki. They had a match that was everything you would expect it to be. And we also had the Briscoes defending their House of Glory tag team titles against Aussie Open, two of the best tag teams in the world today. Talk about a double shot for a main event there. We had El Fantasmo from Bullet Club challenging for the Crown Jewel title against Charles Mason. Jacob Fatu crowned the new House of Glory World Heavyweight Champion for the first time in 3 years. We have a world champion in Hog. So you can catch that and everything else on the show. A lot of great action on this show. On Fight. The replay is up on Fight TV. Our next show is our final show of the year, December 17th. That is a Saturday night. Back at the NYC Arena with Kenta. I just mentioned Kenta a couple of minutes ago. Kenta making his House of Glory debut. 7 weeks after the Brawl Out scrum and the backstage incident involving CM Punk and the Elite, AEW's third-party investigation is now over. And the end result is that Ace Steel was the first one to fall, which you had to expect he would be. Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks are on their way back to television, and CM Punk will likely never wrestle again in an AEW ring. And possibly any ring. Winning the world title in his hometown would not ordinarily be the worst way to go out, if that was the last that we ever see of CM Punk in a wrestling ring, but then he kind of went and sullied all that up in the minutes after the match was over. And it would make, honestly, it would mark a sad end for someone who came back with so much fanfare. He came back with so much promise and so much fan support. You know, winning two world titles and headlining $2 million gates and five of the pay-per-views that he appeared on were AEW's five biggest selling pay-per-views they've ever done. After 7 years away from the business, right? What a story. What a great accomplishment. 7 years away from the business. It only took one for him to piss it all away. With reports of the Elite returning to AEW, Nick Housman of Wrestling Inc. decided that this week would be a good week to reach out to CM Punk's camp for a response. and to see if there was anything they could offer him as far as an update on the investigation, on their status. And much to his surprise, he got a response. Now, Hausman is the one, for those who don't remember, he is the reporter who was in the scrum on that fateful day, who Punk approached or went after first and asked him, aren't you friends with Scott Colton? And Hausman said, as a matter of fact, I'm not anymore. We had a falling out. So Hausman is that person. Hausman said the day after the media scrum, Punk reached out to him to apologize. I guess once he realized that he wasn't friends with Colt Cabana like he thought he still was, that was Punk's way of saying, get over here and give me a hug. Right, now they're best friends. Hausman was told that after the brawl, Punk was asked to stay quiet, and he agreed to do so. From the perspective of Punk's camp, the scrum itself did not seem like a big deal. And that right there tells you how delusional Punk is, or I'm sorry, his camp is. If they thought the scrum itself was no big deal. Oh, it was a big deal. It was a very big deal. Making your boss look like a blithering idiot sitting right next to you and saying that the company's former world champion never accomplished anything in his career when you're not even working a program with him. Yeah, I would say that's a problem. But they claim it wasn't a big deal. It only escalated after the door to Punk's locker room was kicked in and accidentally hit Punk's dog Larry in the face. And then at a pre-scheduled vet appointment a few days later, Punk was informed that two of Larry's teeth had been knocked loose and they had to be removed. Which is the first that anybody is hearing anything about the dog being hurt, even if Punk agreed to keep silent. There are people around him who have floated and could have floated the story a lot sooner, especially everybody was piling on Punk, right? It would have been very easy for them to say, look, let everybody know what happened with the dog here, and let's leak that version of events. This is the first time it's come up in 7 weeks. Hausman was further told that Punk felt threatened and reacted in a legal way under Illinois' Castle Doctrine laws, which allow for the use of force in defense of a person in their dwelling. As far as him throwing the first punch allegedly at, I think it was Matt Jackson. He was also told that following Hangman Adam Page's comments on a May episode of Dynamite, which alluded to backstage concerns about Punk, there was distrust on Punk's end going into his world title match at Double or Nothing, and concern that the match might break down into a real physical fight. I laughed when I read that. I got a good laugh out of that. Noted shooter, or noted hothead, Adam Hangman Page, would what? Well, what's he going to do? He's a single leg Punk to the mat and start raining down hammer fists? Is that what he's known for? Page would be one of the last people I would expect to behave like that, unless he was given a reason to do so, and he had absolutely no reason to do so. That sounds to me like someone working themselves into a shoot. But that's Punk's side of the story. When they say Punk's camp, it's CM Punk's version of events. Dave Meltzer on the F4W message board noted, multiple eyewitnesses said the dog story was a total fabrication. If it was true, the end of the investigation would have been that Punk would be the one staying. And on Observer Radio, Meltzer had this to say. What was said is, basically, it's an outright lie. I did have that told to me. I had heard from Punk's side on and off since a couple of days right after it happened. Never in 7 weeks have I heard anyone mention anything about the door opening and hitting the dog being hurt, or anything like that. I just find that so weird. The side that was trying to defend him all along never brought that up once, and now all of a sudden that's the story. And like I said, the other side just called it a lie. Sean Ross Sapp echoed what Meltzer said. He said he heard the dog was barking a lot because of what was going on, and also because that's what a fucking dog does, it barks. But this is the first that he's hearing of the dog actually being hurt. One person close to the Elite said, so, and again, keep that in mind and take that for what it's worth. This is now their version. One side close to the Elite, i.e. the Elite, told Meltzer, a completely made-up story. Punk is losing in the results of the investigation and is desperate. There was a multiple weeks-long investigation and this was oddly not discovered? Also, it so happened to be mentioned that the moment there was news about the Bucks and Omega possibly coming back, it is insane that people would even humor this. Keep in mind that Hausman claims he reached out to the Punk camp for comment. It wasn't the other way around. As far as the timing of all of this, just to push back on that last part of the quote, where the elite side is wondering, boy, it's awfully convenient that this comes out at a time when rumors were going around that the elite were on their way back. It was Hausman who reached out to Punk. But another person who was in the room seconds after the incident started, who was not affiliated with either side, although they did end up being very negative to Punk after everything went down, said, "The dog story is a complete lie. When the altercation was happening, Punk was a total psycho and could not have cared less about the dog. Kenny picked up the dog to save him from being hurt and gave him to Mega." Mega is their head of legal. "Mega was holding the dog, screaming at Punk to stop. Punk did not even register that his baby was being held by a stranger in the middle of a fight. It did not stop him one bit." Now, I wasn't there. You weren't there. Only a select few people in the room truly know what happened. Is it possible that Punk's dog got hurt? Yes, it's possible. It's possible. It's also possible I could walk out my door and a tree bark could fall and kill me, right? I hope that doesn't happen. Is it possible? Sure it is. I think we need a moratorium on people bringing their dogs to AEW shows. First, it was Cody's dog, right? Remember when they brought Pharaoh out through the tunnel and the poor dog had a coronary when they brought him out and then they shot Pyro off? Some genius thought, hey, I know what we should do. We have a dog out here. Let's shoot fucking Pyro off and scare the shit out of him and give him a heart attack. Now we have poor Larry. Anyone with a pet will tell you that they are a member of the family. You would fight. You would fight to defend them like you would anybody else. And for those who don't know, Larry is a rescue dog. And he was abused by his previous owner. I saw the Paws Chicago video about a year ago on their YouTube channel, where they did this, it's like a short little profile video on Punk and Larry. And Punk told the story of taking him out for a walk one day, and he looked down at Larry and he saw Larry carrying a chicken wing in his mouth. And he said, "Where'd you get that from?" And he went to go reach down to take the chicken wing out of his mouth. And when he did, Larry, bit him up pretty good. And then the dog winced like he had been hit before and he was just waiting for it. You know, you hear stuff like that and it breaks your heart. And anyone who abuses an animal should have various other parts of their body broken, preferably very slowly. So if Larry got hurt, I think that's terrible. But do I believe that Larry got hit in the face by the door? No, I don't. I think that's fiction. Now, per the Observer, several of the top people in the company at Wednesday's show were saying that Punk would not be back. Several top key names have said they would not work with him, with one top star noting Punk won't be back. His value on screen is not 1% worth the hassle and black cloud that he causes backstage. Another top star noted the team has decided that he is out, and regardless of some being willing to work with him, the collective decided that he was voted off the island. One of those top names, and I don't know if he's the one who gave Meltzer that quote, but one of the top names was said to be Chris Jericho, and Fightful Select added to that they were told by numerous sources that Jericho approached CM Punk at Brawl Out, very unhappy about the fight and the scrum that had just taken place, and he told Punk to his face that he was a cancer and a detriment to the company. And those they spoke to said Punk's response, this was not verbatim, but it was effectively, it's none of your business, you need to leave. And it was shortly after that that Jericho came out for the scrum, and he could be seen, you know, when he was leaving, he whispered something to Tony Khan about there being some shit that had just gone down, because Tony was still sitting at the scrum. He had no idea that all of this was going on, all this mayhem was going on just a few feet away from him in the back. But I remember watching Jericho out there during that scrum, and he's out there, and man, he's got a great poker face, I'll say that. He wasn't selling a thing. He was playing it totally cool. You would never know anything was wrong. Jericho is one of the names with John Moxley and Bryan Danielson who really stepped up coming out of that shit show and took charge to try to lead that locker room at a time when they really needed some leadership. And they weren't getting it from other people, including the president of the company. They need people who can lead by example, which is something Moxley has been doing for them all year. Jericho isn't wrong in what he said, if he said it. I wouldn't have said that about Punk before All Out, but after that sad display at the scrum, I said it right after. How can you bring somebody like that back into that locker room? You can't. It would take one hell of a mea culpa from Punk, and that just was not going to happen. It would be just a time bomb waiting to go off again. He had to go. The story about the dog, that isn't the reason that Punk punched first. It would be understandable if he saw the dog get hurt and then started swinging. But as his camp said to Hausman, it had nothing to do with the dog. He felt threatened. And so he took the first shot. The idea of the Bucks and Omega kicking the door in or kicking the door down or whatever that ludicrous story was that came out at the beginning of all this, they entered with the company's head of legal. Should they have gone in there to begin with? No, probably not. I don't think anything good was going to come out of that given the mood that Punk was in. But they were smart enough to at least grab the head of legal and take her into the room with them just in case. You think they're going to be going kicking doors in and being uber aggressive with her standing right there? Why grab her in the first place? Punk challenged anybody at the scrum to come find him if they had something they wanted to talk to him about. I'm not saying it was smart for the elite guys to take him up on that offer. They're EVPs. They should have known better. And it's one of the reasons why I have said that I think they should be stripped of their EVP status. It showed poor judgment on their part, and I just think it creates the possibility also, just them being in that position in the first place, for more conflicts in the future. You have EVPs as the top stars in your company. But I do find it amusing that they did what Punk told them to do, come and find me, and all of a sudden, Punk felt threatened. Very similar thing with the Hangman stuff back in May. I put the blame for that on Tony Khan. He had the chance to nip this in the bud back then. And honestly, if Punk had an issue with it, he should have gone to Tony if he didn't. Maybe he didn't. Tony didn't do anything about it. But if Punk was that upset about what Hangman said in that promo back in May, I don't know why this wasn't a conversation back then. It just goes to the point again that I made after this all went down in September. Communication is the key, and communication would eliminate 90% plus of these types of problems. If this all goes back to that, and I know it's more than just that, it's all the stuff about Colt Cabana, but to think, by the way, that this was all started from about fucking Colt Cabana is what ultimately started all this is just ridiculous to me. But again, to go back to the stuff in May with Hangman, I don't know why this wasn't squashed back then. He had the chance to nip this in the bud after Hangman cut that promo, which, again, didn't make sense. I remember reviewing it live on the air after the show that night, and I said, I had no fucking idea what this guy was talking about. I have to save the company from you. You know, Punk was the babyface going into this match. What are you trying to save the company from Punk for? It didn't make any sense. And he didn't do it. Apparently, he didn't talk to Hangman. He didn't address the issue. Nobody is blameless in this, including Tony Khan. But Meltzer says that Punk was concerned that the match could devolve into a real fight. Fast forward 3 months later when he came back from the broken foot, and what's the very first thing that CM Punk did? He gives Hangman, who there are no plans for him to work with, a receipt on live television for a promo that nobody would have even remembered had he not brought it up again. And in doing so, he created another situation that could have turned into a real fight. And the story is that Punk hated doing that in his interview. He hated calling out Hangman Page the way that he did. And he was afraid that Hangman would play the victim, which he did not. But he was worried that he would. But Punk, I guess, felt like, oh, I had to do it. I have no choice. You know, it's a damn shame that Hangman Page guy forced CM Punk 3 months later to do that promo that he evidently didn't want to do. He did it against his will. I'm sure he had a gun to his head when Page made him do it. I mean, every cowboy carries a gun, right? When all of this first went down, I wasn't sure if Tony Khan had the balls to get rid of his biggest star. I said CM Punk needs to go, but I'm not sure he would, because I don't know that Tony Khan has the guts to get rid of his biggest star, his biggest draw. You know, when you're a top star in anything, it doesn't have to be wrestling. You get special treatment. You have a longer leash than most do when you screw up. Especially if you're making your team, your boss, your company, you're making them a shitload of money, you're going to have a longer leash than most. I just read off some of his business milestones since coming to AEW. All the positive that he did. Tony Khan vehemently, months and months ago, vehemently defending CM Punk from Eric Bischoff. Eric Bischoff's criticism, I think, that CM Punk didn't really do much for AEW business. And Tony Khan launched into this passionate, full-throated defense with Punk sitting right next to him. This, I believe, was at the scrum in May when Punk won the championship. They were sitting next to each other again. And there's Tony Khan going off, giving him the most passionate defense that you've ever heard in your life. He's been Tony Khan's biggest draw over the past year. He didn't want it to come to this. Punk was at the top of Tony's wish list when he started AEW. For him to part ways with Punk, which is what it looks like is going to end up happening here. I mean, I've talked about the report of AEW looking to buy out the remainder of Punk's contract. The only hang-up is said to be the length of the non-compete. For it to even get to that point, you know that you've screwed up. And I'll tell you who I have sympathy for. I have sympathy for all of those CM Punk fans who were so excited 1 year ago when he came back. They waited 7 years for this, to see him crash and burn in the way that he has, with back-to-back surgeries and then the scrum and the muffins and the fight, all of it, and go down like this. It's got to be a shitty feeling. And I have gotten plenty of comments online from a lot of very angry CM Punk fans. They're very upset. They're very emotional. I have sympathy for them. This is not how they expected this run to end. I don't have sympathy for Punk. He brought this on himself. But if you are a CM Punk fan, this is not the way you wanted this story to end. But he left them no choice. And it won't make those fans feel any better that Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks are on their way back to TV. They aired a teaser on Dynamite Wednesday night showing various clips and still images, including video from the BTE episode 4 years ago announcing the formation of AEW. All of these clips where they would be on screen and then suddenly they would disappear. Right down to the AEW logo at the very end of the segment that then evaporated. The announcers never acknowledged them. They were backstage on Wednesday, but they did not appear on TV. And now we only have a few weeks left before Full Gear. I think they're setting up for them to challenge for the Trios titles against Death Triangle. They were the Trios champs. They got stripped. And my guess is they're just going to put the belts right back on them and pick up where they were supposed to be, coming out of All Out. That's going to make some people big mad. But for Tony Khan, it's a couple of big names to get back. Plus, I saw Malakai Black posted a little teaser vignette on Instagram that looked to be new footage of him and Brody King and Buddy Matthews, so the House of Black could be back soon as well. You know, the sooner they could put all this shit behind them and get some more, you know, big names and relatively big names back on TV, the better off they'll be. Now, keeping with the CM Punk theme, GiveMeSport.com did an interview with WrestleVotes, or the person who runs the WrestleVotes account on Twitter, which has been accurate in the past many times. And he shared a few pieces of news. It sounds like Triple H's stance on signing CM Punk may have softened in the past few months. WrestleVotes claimed that shortly after Triple H took over creative in July, he wanted nothing to do with CM Punk, and even less to do with Phil Brooks. That's what he was told in July. He asked the question again in recent days and was told that he has softened a little bit in that opinion. He told the website, "I still think there's animosity. I still think there's a lot of pieces that need to be picked up between the two of them specifically. But Hunter learned from Vince, and Vince made amends with everybody. So to say that door is closed is ridiculous on anybody's part, especially in this quote-unquote war that's happening right now. I would never say never. Absolutely." If you listened to the podcast last week, I said the exact same thing. And no, I am not WrestleVotes. Although if I was, I wouldn't tell you. But I said it last week that anybody doubting the idea that CM Punk could end up back in WWE and thinking, oh, it's impossible, it's never going to happen, you are fooling yourself. Of course he can. Where there is business to be done, Vince McMahon put his ego aside plenty of times. He worked with plenty of people that he had a falling out with or maybe didn't like and who did not leave on the best of terms. I think it's an unnecessary risk, especially considering how things ended up with him in AEW. If I'm Triple H, I'm looking at that as a giant red flag. And also, file this away, too. Keep this in mind. Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks will eventually be negotiating for new deals. Eventually, their AEW contracts are going to come due, and they're either going to re-sign with Tony Khan, or they're going to become free agents and take the best offer that they're given. The Bucks were very complimentary of Triple H after their discussions with him when he was courting them the last time. Ultimately, they chose to go and help form AEW, but they were close. You know, they were very seriously considering, after they left New Japan, going to WWE. If Triple H ever wants to make a play for Omega, or the Bucks, or both, that could pose a problem. If CM Punk comes back to WWE, that could pose a problem. So, which future potential acquisition is more important, do you think, to Triple H? I mean, none of these people may end up going to WWE, but if he has to prioritize one over the other, who do you think he would prefer to work with? Tony Khan made his weekly Busted Open radio appearance on Wednesday, and near the end of the show, he took time to address the perception that every match on the show needs to have a long storyline build to it, and he took aim specifically at Eric Bischoff. Bischoff was upset with Tony tweeting. Let's take this back a little bit here. Because Bischoff has a lot of things that he critiques AEW about, and some of it is valid, and some of it just comes off as just him being grouchy. But let's go back about a year. It's about a year ago. There was a tweet that Tony Khan put out that WCW would still be in business on TNT and TBS if Ted Turner knew 1% of what he knows about pro wrestling. Now, from what I can gather, that was the comment that caused a rift in their relationship because they had a cordial relationship, friendship up to that point. Bischoff has made a few appearances on AEW television, although not since then. But that may have been what caused a rift in their relationship because Bischoff went on his podcast after that and he took aim at Tony for saying that. And it was a stupid thing for Tony to say because, you know, he knows his history. Tony Khan is not a stupid person. He knows his wrestling history. He's been a wrestling nerd, a wrestling mark for many years, right? Like many of us. And he should know that regardless of what Ted Turner did or did not know about the wrestling business or how big of a fan he was, it would not have stopped the AOL Time Warner merger from happening and Ted was being iced out of his own company. He didn't have the power at that point that he once had. He got squeezed out. Once that happened, WCW no longer had friends in high places. The ultimate friend in the highest of places. The people in power did not want wrestling on their networks, and that ultimately is what finished off WCW. WCW was already sick. WCW was terminally ill. Once they pulled the plug on the TV, that's basically when they pulled the plug. So even if WCW had lived on or been relaunched, as Bischoff wanted to do, they would not have been on TNT or TBS. This all started, by the way, Tony's original tweet was in response to a report that was floating around at the time about people internally in WWE complaining that Tony Khan overspent like Ted Turner did to compete with them and how we beat Ted Turner and Ted Turner is smarter than Tony Khan. That's what caused Tony to respond the way he did. He didn't just wake up one morning and said, hey, let me shit on Ted Turner. That was his way. He was responding literally to a Wrestling Inc. tweet that he quote tweeted when he made that comment. Those people in WWE who may have said that are idiots too for thinking that because Vince McMahon did not beat Ted Turner. I know that's their narrative and, you know, the winners get to write history the way they want to, but Vince McMahon did not beat Ted Turner. If he beat anybody, he beat Eric Bischoff. And frankly, Bischoff and everybody that came after him that were running that shit show that WCW turned into, they're the ones who beat WCW. And the merger just finished it off. But Vince McMahon always loves to gloat that he beat Ted Turner because it sounds sexier that way. It's like when he gloats that he beat the government. He does the same thing about... He's always had a bee in his bonnet for Ted Turner, going back decades. But in the years since then, Bischoff has levied lots of other criticisms at AEW, and Tony brought up one of those critiques on Busted Open. He said, "Frankly, the person that has been the most incendiary, contradictory, and hypocritical on this entire point is Eric Bischoff." And then he explained that to him, to Tony, the good WCW Monday Nitros from 95 to 98 featured random lucha matches and other unexpected pairings. He said there was a certain exquisite randomness to the lineup of the card. There were a lot of stories happening in WCW, but probably less than half the matches on Nitro had a story going into them, and that was fine. It was the industry standard show. And he implied that WCW copied WWE's method of doing things where every single match had to be happening for a reason. He said his own reason for a seemingly random pairing could be the start of something new, or just a challenge to see who's the best. He said, to see the person who probably put more cold matches on TV and did it successfully and did it well, say that it is an abomination to do it is pretty contradictory. I definitely don't want to see fans get brainwashed into thinking that there's only one way to do this just because they've seen it done one way for a long time. There are times where the pairings feel very random on Dynamite, but I don't think it's too much of an issue anymore than it was for WCW back in the day. It's like the people who say that AEW is nothing but matches with no stories. These are people who clearly do not watch the product. So I decided to take a look at this week's Dynamite as an example. The past is the past. Let's look at this week, okay? This week's Dynamite, what did we have? We had Chris Jericho and Daniel Garcia against Claudio and Wheeler Yuta. There's multiple stories playing out in that one match. One of them is, I think, the longer-term story of Garcia challenging Jericho, eventually, for the ROH title. You've got the Blackpool Combat Club, which they're now teasing dissension within the ranks between Bryan Danielson and Wheeler Yuta, right? They got the win with Claudio pinning Jericho. That should set Claudio up now to challenge Jericho again to try to get his belt back. And if not, I'll be the first one to say that doesn't make any sense. In fact, Jericho's having an open challenge this Wednesday. And if Claudio is not the first man out there, unless somebody lays him out in the back on his way to the ring, if he's not the first man out that curtain, that's going to look pretty goofy. Okay, unless they have a damn good reason for it. But they won the match on Wednesday, and the first thing we saw in the back was Yuta getting up in Danielson's face again and telling him, you know, we just won our match, basically challenging him to go out and do the same later on in his match against Sammy Guevara, which he did. So that's two matches on the show that had a storyline purpose. We had FTR against Swerve and Our Glory to see who would get to challenge the Acclaimed for the tag team titles. So that match served a purpose. They were crowning a number one contender. That now sets up a match with FTR that they have been teasing for weeks with them and the Gun Club, who were sitting in the front row and prevented them from winning the match. We had Jamie Hayter beating Riho. Riho just returned, so you want to get her on TV. But Hayter got the win. Jamie Hayter is the one who's been getting over with the audience organically on her own. The people chant her name everywhere she goes, even though she's standing right next to Britt Baker, who they hate. You've got to find a way to get Jamie Hayter on TV and give her a win, because it now looks like she's going to be next in line challenging Toni Storm for the interim women's title. And then we had, in the main event, Jon Moxley defending the AEW world title against Penta. Now, there was not much of a storyline reason for it, but I'm not complaining about getting a Jon Moxley Penta match on free TV, especially when you know that Penta is not challenging for the world title at Full Gear. He's not challenging for the world title at Revolution or Double or Nothing. He's not going to get a pay-per-view main event for the world championship anytime soon. It is a first-time ever match that we've never seen before. But in the end, even that match served a purpose. It served the purpose of getting Jon Moxley in the main event on that show. It almost didn't even matter who it was against, because it set up the ending of the show with the Firm attacking Moxley. MJF comes out, he fires the Firm, and then MJF gets laid out, which I'm guessing sets up the whole can they coexist tag team match with Moxley and MJF against the Firm at some point in the next few weeks. That was the show on Wednesday. Everything served a purpose. My one critique, especially with Penta challenging Moxley for the world title, they need to get rid of any pretense of having rankings in this company. The rankings do not exist anymore. They have a ranking section on the website that has not been updated since August 31st. Get rid of them. Take the page down. If you're not going to update them anymore, I don't know why that link is even up. Take the whole section down. On Rampage Friday night, AEW announced another World Title Eliminator Tournament with the finals taking place at Full Gear and the winner getting a championship match at Winter is Coming on December 14th. Another fucking tournament. We had two Owen Hart tournaments in May, an All-Atlantic Championship tournament in June. We had a Trios title tournament that just wrapped up a couple of months ago. We had the Grand Slam Tournament of Champions, and now the Full Gear Eliminator. At least in June, when Punk got hurt the first time, they did a Battle Royal with the winner meeting Jon Moxley later on that night. So they changed it up a little bit. But I mean, it's been tournament overload. And to be fair to Tony Khan, we never would have had the tournament that we had last month had CM Punk not gotten hurt. And the Full Gear one has become an annual thing the past couple of years. The finals 2 years ago at Full Gear was Kenny Omega against Hangman Page. Omega won, and then he went on to turn heel and win the world title, if you remember that. And then last year, it was Miro against Bryan Danielson. Yeah, that guy Miro, who may or may not still work for AEW. I have no idea since we never see him anymore. But it was Miro against Bryan Danielson. It would have been Jon Moxley and Bryan Danielson, but Moxley checked himself into rehab on Halloween last year. The first entrant announced was Dante Martin, and the second entrant in the tournament is Ethan Page. We do not have a bracket yet. Those are the only names that have been announced so far. There's no reason that Wardlow, as the TNT champion, should not be in this tournament. Unless they have a TNT title defense in mind for him at Full Gear, which they should. But, you know, he's been doing the whole War Joe thing recently, feuding with the Kingdom and people that nobody gives a fuck about. There's really no other reason Wardlow should not be in this tournament. It may be the only way to get him on the pay-per-view. And think about this, if MJF wins the title from Moxley, it sets up a rematch for Winter is Coming with MJF as the champion defending against Wardlow. And obviously there's history there between the two of them. I've given up as far as Miro, I mentioned him. I've given up on trying to figure out what's going on with him. Ricky Starks and Powerhouse Hobbs, there's absolutely no reason they should not be in this thing. Starks got that big win over Hobbs at Rampage Grand Slam. I was in the building that night watching it, trying to keep my eyes open at 12:30 in the morning, but they had a great match, and it was a big win for Ricky Starks, and you'd have to put out an all-points bulletin since then to try to find out where this guy is. I think he put a tweet up the other day. The one thing Ricky does that I don't like, he'll tweet something and then delete it. He pulls the tweet and delete shit all the time. You know, he's the one after there was... the back and forth with Andrade and Sammy a few weeks ago, who put that tweet up and said, can my coworkers just shut the fuck up for a second? And then he deleted that tweet also. But he put a tweet up this week, I think, in response to people wondering where he is, basically saying, I'm okay, I'm here. And then he took that tweet down. You would have to put fucking, you know, posters on trees asking, have you seen this man? So whatever good that win did him against Hobbs, or may have done for him, is gone because he hasn't been around to follow up on it. The key is not just in paying things off. The key is once you pay them off, you need to have a good plan to follow up with. Same thing with Wardlow when he beat MJF at Double or Nothing. What was their plan to follow up with him? It wasn't a very good one. They eventually put the TNT title on him, but look at what they've done with Wardlow since then. You're going to tell me that's good booking? You're going to tell me that Wardlow is in a better position now than he was 6 months ago? He was in a better position 6 months and 9 months ago when he was standing in MJF's shadow. And you can say the same thing now about Ricky Starks. They're doing the same thing to Starks that they did with Wardlow. I think MJF is winning the championship, and I don't think he's going babyface yet. You know, the firm laid him out on Wednesday, but I think it's all part of a ruse. The person I would have win the tournament is Darby Allin. If I had to pick who's my pick, Darby Allin would be my pick. Darby has a match with Jay Lethal on Wednesday. They could easily turn that into a first-round match in the tournament and have Darby go over and move on to the next round. Darby wins the whole thing, and we get a rematch at Winter is Coming from last year's Full Gear with him and MJF. They had a tremendous match at Full Gear to open the show last year. two of the young pillars of the company. Neither one are former WWE guys. You could say these are really homegrown. I mean, I know Darby, you know, he bounced around a few places before AEW, but and so did MJF, you know, on the indie scene. But really, on a national scale, this is their home. They are truly AEW guys. So it would be cool to see them build up a big world title match between the two of them. But you can't go wrong with Ricky Starks either. There's still time to fix the mistake they've made by not featuring him as much as they should, and get Starks out there on TV and have him win the tournament. If I had a number two pick, a backup pick to Darby, it would be Ricky Starks. And Mike Tyson will be back with AEW this Friday night for a special live episode of Rampage in Atlantic City. Mike has had a few fights there in his day. He's no stranger to Atlantic City. They're bringing Tyson in to do commentary, and they just signed the deal a few days ago. And while the specifics of the deal are not yet known, the belief is that it may include multiple appearances and not just be a one-off appearance. There was a time where it looked like they were setting up to a possible match with Tyson and Jericho in AEW back during the pandemic shows when they were doing them at Daly's Place. But they never followed up on it, and nothing ever came out of it. Now, the Give Me Sport interview I mentioned earlier with WrestleVotes yielded some other news, and it's positive news on the WWE side, if this is true. Again, right now, this is just coming from WrestleVotes. He claims that the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view is now considered to be completely dead. That is the show itself, not the match concept. Triple H is quite fond of the match itself. I think he's number two, I want to say, on the list of most Hell in a Cell matches in history, behind The Undertaker. I think Randy Orton might be tied with him for number two. But the belief is that he is going to save the stipulation to blow off big feuds, which is how it always should have been used. The worst thing that ever happened to Hell in a Cell was turning it into a pay-per-view. They killed it. They turned it into just another match. And then a few years ago, they painted it red. And I hope that WWE offers a good vision plan as part of its benefits package so that whoever came up with the idea to give it a paint job can get their fucking eyes checked. Because that thing is an eyesore. The first Hell in a Cell pay-per-view they ever did was 2009. And on that very first show, they did three Hell in a Cell matches on one show. Three! In one night. You don't think that's overkill? 2012. They did the end of an era. Hell in a Cell match at WrestleMania. Even though they had a Hell in a Cell pay-per-view later in the year. And that was the beginning of the end on that show for Ryback, if you remember. Because when John Cena got hurt, Ryback got his spot against CM Punk. And they didn't want to put the title on Ryback. So they had to beat him. And he was never the same after that. But it hasn't all been bad. I don't want to make it out to be like, oh, this every Hell in a Cell match has been shit and there's been nothing good to come out of these shows. There have been some great Hell in a Cell matches since 2009. And I scratched together a quick list of my favorite Cell matches of the pay-per-view era. Because I am hoping this news is true. Even though nothing's been made official yet, I am hoping it's true. And I said, well, now would be a good time to pay tribute to the positive that have come out of the Hell in a Cell pay-per-views. Now, this is not ranked or anything, and I am going to include one match that was not on a Hell in a Cell pay-per-view. I'm going to include the Seth Rollins and Edge Hell in a Cell match from Crown Jewel last year, even though, again, it was in Saudi Arabia, it was not on the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, just because it was such a great match. One of the best Cell matches, honestly, of the past 10 years. Got to show that match some love. But keeping it to the pay-per-view, Cody Rhodes against Seth Rollins from earlier this year. That's one that's going to be talked about years from now because of the injury to Cody. And it's one that made sense to do inside the Cell because it paid off a months-long feud between the two of them. Sasha Banks against Bayley in 2020. They had a great one, which is not easy to do because they did that in the Thunderdome. They did that in front of no fans. And I hated that. I hate that whole no fans era. It's terrible. Hopefully they never have to go back to that again. But they went out there and they had a hell of a match. Sasha Banks and Becky Lynch in 2019. The only redeeming part of that entire show was the opening match they had inside the Cell. They had an excellent match. The Usos and the New Day tag team Hell in a Cell in 2017 may be my favorite match those two teams have ever had. And think about how many hundreds of matches it feels like those two teams have had over the years. But it had everything. It was violent, as violent as a match could be in you know, PG WWE without blood. There was drama, there was great action, some innovative spots in there, just tremendous stuff from these two teams. The greatest tag team Hell in a Cell match that I have ever seen. Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker in 2015, that one did have blood, and I loved how Undertaker had been kicking Brock in the dick for months, and in the end, the dick kicker got what he deserved. They surprised me, honestly, with how good that match was. So those are my six favorites of the pay-per-view era. You already know what my least favorite one is. You know what the worst Hell in a Cell match of all time is. Seth Rollins and The Fiend in 2019. It belongs in a landfill. It stinks so much. Anytime you have a Hell in a Cell match with a finish like that, I don't care how good the match is up to that point, it's going straight to the bottom of the pile. We didn't even get that with that match. I can't even sit here and tell you, well, it was good until the end. No, it wasn't good at all. The whole thing was shit. Roman Reigns and Braun Strowman in 2018, when Braun cashed in his Money in the Bank and failed, that was the worst of all the matches that Roman Reigns and Braun Strowman ever had, and they had some good ones. This was not one of them. With an absolutely horrendous finish. Ended in a no contest. And if I remember, I think there may have actually been a referee botch with Mick Foley in that one as well. But terrible. And the last one I'll put on my worst of list here. Undertaker and Kane in 2010. That was pretty fucking bad. They were moving in slow motion in that match. Especially Undertaker. Paul Bearer turns on the Undertaker. I mean, where have I seen that one before? Just awful. Awful. One of the worst matches those two have ever had. So those are my least favorite Hell in a Cell matches from the pay-per-view era. WrestleVotes also spoke of there being talk within WWE of doing the Money in the Bank matches at WrestleMania and having the men's ladder match on one night and having the women's ladder match on another night. This is, again, it's like getting rid of the Cell pay-per-view, something I pitched just last week. Now we're learning that those same discussions have taken place within the halls of Titan Tower. I like it when common sense prevails. I'm not used to this. I'm used to the exact opposite. I'm going to be doing this show 15 years next month. And let me tell you, the majority of those 15 years I have been railing against pretty much the complete opposite of common sense. So it's nice when I start hearing things about, you know, decisions that are being made or things that are being changed or overturned that make sense. I love it. I could get used to this. Dave Meltzer is reporting that Bray Wyatt has become the top merch seller over the Bloodline. And the idea is that Roman Reigns against Bray Wyatt could be the biggest program in a very long time since Wyatt is so hot right now. Bray is currently listed on the depth chart internally as the top babyface on SmackDown, with Drew McIntyre being moved down into the number two spot. Now, I see a lot of people on social media saying, oh, Dave Meltzer is reporting that the plan is for Bray Wyatt to wrestle Roman Reigns, or the match is going to happen at WrestleMania. He never said the match was planned, only that it could be their biggest program in a while because Bray is so over right now. Somehow, as is often the case with stuff that Meltzer says on his shows, that ends up being more of his own thought process, it gets reported as news. Fightful said that nobody in WWE is claiming that this match is being planned. One source in the company claimed the idea of Reigns against Wyatt being an imminent program was false. They were told by this person, where would we go from there? Another source noted that they learned from the Fiend run. I hope so. I hope that they learned a lot of lessons from the Fiend run and the Fiend booking under Vince McMahon. Roman Reigns against Bray Wyatt could be a big match at some point. Bray's only been back a few weeks. You see the reactions he's getting. You see all the buzz online. All these videos and everything, you know, that they're talking about how on social media, you know, combined, all these videos are doing millions and millions of views across multiple platforms. There's definitely an interest in the Bray Wyatt storyline and the Bray Wyatt segments on TV. And if he is slotted in internally as the number one babyface on that brand, and Roman Reigns is obviously the number one heel, the number one babyface eventually gets in the ring with the number one heel. Although you can never predict what the fans or who the fans are going to get behind 6 months from now. It could be somebody else. Or somebody could get hurt. Anything can happen. Bray Wyatt hasn't even wrestled a match. He hasn't gotten back in the ring. And people are already fantasy booking him and Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. Now look, I understand that there is a history between the two of them. The Fiend, the last time he was the champion, he lost that title. I believe that was the triple threat with Roman and Strowman and the Fiend. And Roman won the title. And remember, Roman stood over him and said, "You're just a freak in a mask." And he's the one who took the championship away from Bray Wyatt. Roman has not lost that title since he beat Bray Wyatt to win the Universal Championship. He's gone 700-800 days, whatever number he's up to at this point, has not lost the title. Is there a story there for it to kind of come full circle, come back to Bray, and Bray gets the belt back from the guy who took it from him? Yes, that could be one story, but he doesn't need it. He doesn't need the title. This is going to be the people who think, oh, he should get a championship match. This is going to end up being the same exact thing that happened with The Fiend. They put The Fiend in a Hell in a Cell match, gave us the shit finish they gave us, which you should never do in a Hell in a Cell match. A few weeks later in Saudi Arabia, they put the belt on The Fiend. Now what? Because they were booking him as this unbeatable monster, this Undertaker-type character, where The Undertaker, when he first came into the company, you know, you couldn't do anything to this guy. You would hit him, he would no-sell it, he would do the zombie sit-up. You know, that was in 1990. Things are different now. If he's going to go in there, I mean, at some point, that's going to get old. You're going to put the belt on him, and you what? You're going to put him in the ring with top names. He's not going to sell for them. He's going to have to sell for them. He's going to go out there and have to have good matches and entertaining matches. And that just wasn't what the Fiend character was about. That's not how they booked the character when he was out there. Putting the title on him right now would be the worst thing that they could do. They need to take their time with this. Let them tell the story, the Uncle Howdy stuff. They might introduce new characters. We don't know. The Wyatt Six, right? There's a lot of speculation about where this is all going. But he hasn't even had a match yet. So I think we need to pump the brakes on this as an idea. Roman Reigns has plenty of options as far as who he could be in the ring with at WrestleMania. Obviously, The Rock is always going to be at the top of that list. If they can get The Rock, we know that's the match they're going to do. If they can't get The Rock, then they don't have The Rock. You got Cody Rhodes, who may be back even before the Royal Rumble. Cody Rhodes is certainly, he'd be my choice. I mean, he's pretty much near or at the top of the list of potential opponents for Roman Reigns or WrestleMania. Could you work something where it's him and Sami Zayn? Yeah, you could. I think that's very pie in the sky to think that they're going to give Sami Zayn a world title main event at WrestleMania. I don't care how good this storyline is going. I don't see that happening. But you can look out there and you can find even Braun Strowman leading into WrestleMania. You can get a pay-per-view main event out of that. The two of them have worked well together in the past. There are different people that Roman could work with. Doesn't have to be Bray Wyatt. WWE has announced that the Bell Center in Montreal will host next year's Elimination Chamber pay-per-view on Saturday, February 18th, marking the first pay-per-view to take place in Montreal in 14 years. And SmackDown will also emanate from the Bell Center the night before on the 17th. They just had a very successful stretch of live events through Canada recently. Sami Zayn was super over in his home province of Quebec. So let me paint a picture for you of how this needs to go. SmackDown on Friday night had one of the best segments all year with the Bloodline. And they had this tremendous moment right down to the way they filmed it, where Jey Uso and Sami Zayn were in another one of their arguments. And Jey Uso got so fired up that he said, "I don't give a damn what the tribal chief says." And Roman Reigns, his head snapped up. I mean, this was just perfect. And what I think was supposed to be a serious segment devolved into just pure comedy, but it was immensely entertaining, where Sami Zayn was cracking everybody in the ring up. He broke every member of the Bloodline in this segment. This was a tremendous piece of work. And Sami, all he did was, you know, he said the Usy line, and he was making certain facial expressions and smiling. He doesn't have to do much. He doesn't have to do much. Roman could hardly contain himself. Jey Uso looked like he was struggling to survive. Jimmy Uso already knew it was coming before the line was even delivered. He was in another part of the ring looking out to the crowd covering his face. Paul Heyman had a smile on his face. Solo Sikoa may have been the only one who didn't break, but they didn't really shoot him much on TV. So who knows? He could have been busting a gut off screen for all we know. This man broke the entire faction in one segment. I don't want this story to end. Survivor Series suddenly feels too soon to excommunicate Sammy from the group, although they could still, I mean, they could further the story in the War Games match. I still think that's the way to go. But as far as ending this and kicking Sammy out of the group next month, it's too soon for that. But with the Chamber being in Montreal, I think we see Roman Reigns defending his titles inside the Chamber. It's not going to be a number one contenders match. The past 2 years, the Chamber has been for the WWE Championship. And Sami Zayn is going to be in one of the pods in that match. Kevin Owens should be in that match as well. You fill out the rest of the field any way you want. This is how we end up with Roman Reigns and Sami Zayn in the ring together in Montreal, the final two in the Elimination Chamber match. Now, I would love to see Roman and Sami one-on-one, but the show is called Elimination Chamber. That's going to be the main event of the show. It's going to be inside the chamber. So you do it inside the chamber and you have it come down to those two, and Roman maybe expects Sami to do the right thing and lay down for the bloodline. This is what Roman Reigns has been buddying up to him for this entire time. To him, Sami Zayn is a useful idiot. He's a tool that he can use at his disposal. Well, he's a tool. To him, he's a tool in more than one way. But he's a tool. He's an instrument for him to use any way he wishes. That's why he wants to keep him around. That plus he's entertaining. But now when push comes to shove and it comes down to those two and Roman needs Sami to step up and do the right thing, Sami can't do it. He's not going to lay down for him. He fights back. He tries to win the championship. Imagine the crowd in Canada hanging on to every near fall or even just one. All you need is one. One near fall is all you need. In the end, the rest of the bloodline, they cost Sami. They beat him down. And it leads perfectly into WrestleMania and Owens and Zayn reuniting to challenge the Usos to win the tag team titles. It all just plays out so well. But Survivor Series, way too soon. I am enjoying this way too much to even think about pitching the idea of splitting all of these guys up in the next 4 weeks. I think that would be ridiculous. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp Therapy Online. I will admit, there have been times where I wish life came with a user manual. Case in point, when I first started doing this podcast 15 years ago, there are things I know now that I wish I knew then, when I was just starting out. And it's not even anything glaring, it's just little things here and there. Unfortunately, life does not come with a user manual. So when it's not working for you, it's okay to feel like you're stuck. Therapists are trained to help you figure out what's causing the issues that you may be dealing with right now in your life. It's what they do. BetterHelp has connected over 3 million people with licensed therapists. It's convenient, secure, and accessible from anywhere because it is 100% online. Even if you're the kind of person who doesn't do well with one-on-one interaction, you don't like going face-to-face and getting personal with someone about your problems, you're hesitant to open up, you're shy, you're timid, whatever it might be, you don't have to go face-to-face with anyone when you use BetterHelp. That's one of the things I liked about it when I used it. I was able to stay in my comfort zone and still get the one-on-one help that I was looking for. Therapy can help you deal with your problems in a completely judgment-free zone. BetterHelp makes it easy to get started. It has all the benefits of in-person therapy, plus it's more convenient and more affordable. Just fill out a short questionnaire to match with a therapist, and if you feel like things aren't clicking for any reason, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. There's no waiting room to sit in. You log in and you're there. So if you're feeling stuck, get unstuck with BetterHelp. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/solomonster. That's betterhelp.com/solomonster. We have an update on Carl Anderson and the saga here of him as the never open weight champion. Is he or is he not going to be wrestling again for New Japan? Frankly, I think the Nakamura news with Pro Wrestling Noah should put this story to bed once and for all. But New Japan posted on Wednesday, this is what they said. Thank you for supporting New Japan. Early morning Japan. Easy for me to say. Early morning Japan. There we go. Early morning Japan time on October 20th. Never openweight champion Carl Anderson posted a video on social media indicating that he would not be making his advertised commitment on November 5th in Osaka. NJPW had announced his match with Hikuleo for the Never Openweight Championship on October 4th. Despite comments from Doc Gallows to the contrary in Anderson's video, the booking was made through the appropriate channels and with Anderson's expressed approval. However, after the match's announcement, both Gallows and Anderson would appear on the October 10th edition of WWE Monday Night Raw. This led to WWE announcing a match featuring both men for their Saudi Arabia event on November 5th, in direct conflict with Anderson's prior commitment. New Japan has, for the past several days, attempted to negotiate with Anderson, but has not been met with a response. Should Anderson decide to renege on his scheduled championship match, he will be required to vacate the Never Openweight Championship and return the title belt to New Japan immediately. New Japan holds its champions to the highest standards of professionalism and sincerely apologizes to fans for any disappointment or inconvenience caused by this matter. Carl Anderson then responded on Twitter. He said, "I'm not vacating anything. I'm the greatest Never Openweight Champion of all time. I will defend it on my time. Get with my booking agent." And then he tagged Luke Gallows. And said, "I'll see you then, Hikuleo. That's hashtag too sweet." Per Fightful Select, Carl Anderson is still expected to compete in New Japan, even though he came back to WWE. I think that's been pretty obvious. The moment they put that kayfabe video in character up on Instagram about a week ago, I think it became pretty obvious that they're all working an angle here. But Fightful says there are, and always have been, active plans for Anderson to compete in New Japan. We have not heard an update on the title itself, but that New Japan does expect Anderson to fulfill additional dates, which WWE was fine with. Beyond that, we're told New Japan has been aware that Anderson and Gallows were heading to WWE as far back as August, and that is when the deal was hammered out. Those familiar with the situation say that things are fine between Anderson, WWE, and New Japan. So that's your answer right there. If you were still wondering what's going on with Carl Anderson, I don't see any way for him to be at the event on November 5th, but I have every expectation that he'll be at the Tokyo Dome on January 4th. So Anderson will be at Crown Jewel, and since the show is this Saturday, and I'm not doing another podcast here until next Sunday, let me run down the card and give you my early predictions. And look, they could always add another match on TV tomorrow night. You know, maybe Seth Rollins against Ali for the U.S. title or something. But if anything major changes, I could run through this again on the stream on Friday night. This is the card as it stands. We have Omos one-on-one with Braun Strowman. This is the big man match on the card. The shorter they keep this, the better off it'll be. This match could surprise some people, but I think only if they keep it to a relatively short period of time, whether that's 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 5 minutes max. This should not be a very long match. I got Braun Strowman going over here. There is more potential in Braun Strowman as a challenger to Roman Reigns than there is Omos challenging pretty much anybody for any championship. Karrion Kross one-on-one with Drew McIntyre inside of a steel cage. We had a Karrion Kross win on SmackDown Friday night. No Drew McIntyre, who was celebrating the wedding of his best mate. Sheamus got married this week and Drew McIntyre was the best man. But they're going to have a cage match. That is to keep out Scarlett, who, I mean, we all know how that goes when you have a cage to try to keep people out. But I think that this is a win that Drew McIntyre needs. Karrion Kross won their first match. He had to. Look, it's not ideal to be beating him this soon if he's one of the top heels on the brand. But Drew McIntyre, he needs a W. I think he gets one here. The Judgment Day take on AJ Styles, Karl Anderson, and Luke Gallows. I am going to go... This could go either way. I'm going to go with the Judgment Day. I think the Judgment Day gets the win. Bianca Belair defends the Raw Women's Championship against Bayley in a last woman standing match, which would be a way to get the title off of Bianca without pinning her, but I thought the same thing about them adding the ladder match stipulation, and Bianca still won. I think Bianca's going to win again, because as I look ahead to WrestleMania, I don't see Bayley in the Raw Women's Championship match. I see Bianca against one of two people. I think it's either Bianca and Charlotte, or Bianca in the match I would do, Bianca and Rhea. Bianca Belair and Rhea Ripley should be the Raw Women's title match at WrestleMania, or sooner, but preferably at WrestleMania. So I think Bianca, and I hope that Bianca holds on to the title. The Usos defend the tag team championships against the Brawling Brutes, Ridge Holland and Butch. Usos are not losing those titles. There is a 0% chance that the Usos will lose those titles. They're going over. We have Brock Lesnar one-on-one with Bobby Lashley. Brock Lesnar lost to Bobby Lashley at the Royal Rumble. Brock Lesnar lost to Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. Brock Lesnar lost again to Roman Reigns at SummerSlam. That's a lot of losing for someone who is supposed to be this unstoppable beast. Brock lost a lot in putting over Roman Reigns. And he should have, because Roman Reigns is the top guy in the company. Brock did exactly what he was supposed to do. He put him over. But I think now it feels like it's time for the pendulum to swing the other way. I think Brock is going to get that win back from Bobby in this match. Roman Reigns, one-on-one with Logan Paul, is our main event for the undisputed WWE Championship. They have been doing their damnedest on TV to try to convince us that Logan Paul has a punching chance of winning. All it takes is one punch. He was in Glendale, Arizona last night to watch his brother Jake Paul beat UFC legend Anderson Silva in a boxing match. He beat him via unanimous decision. He is now 6-0 in his boxing career. He called out Nate Diaz after the fight. He called out Canelo Alvarez. They're going to mention that fact on Saturday. And they're going to try to convince you that Logan Paul can do the same thing that his brother did. But Logan Paul has about as much chance of leaving Saudi Arabia as the champion as I do. So Roman Reigns will retain. I think this is going to end up being a very good match. From what little we have seen of Logan Paul, this is only his second singles match. Third match of his entire life. What little we have seen of him, he is more than capable in the ring. He's an athlete. He looks the part. He can do things in the ring that are very impressive for somebody who hasn't been training at this for very long. You know, I know he's been in the ring at the PC training with Shawn Michaels recently. I think he and Roman are going to go out there and have a hell of a match. But Roman Reigns will retain. So that is the card as it stands. Show airs on Saturday at noon Eastern, pre-show at 11 a.m. on Peacock. As soon as it ends, I will be live on YouTube next Saturday for the review, so figure around 4 o'clock or so. This is going to be the first of three pay-per-views coming up in the month of November. Busy, busy. Busy, busy in November. I call it NSTD, no sleep till December. We have an update, finally, at long last, on the status of Tommaso Ciampa, who has been missing from television for weeks and has not wrestled since a match with Bobby Lashley last month in Bakersfield. On Wednesday, Ciampa posted on Instagram, "The road to recovery begins. It is a familiar road, almost too familiar. Special thanks to Dr. Emblem and his team for taking such incredible care of me. Thanks to the WWE medical staff for once again putting me back together, and thanks to my nurses at home for always giving me perspective. It took a while, but we finally found the cause to all of that glute and back pain, a hip labrum that looked like shredded cheese, according to my wife who watched the surgery." And then he ended with a Rocky Balboa quote, "But it ain't about how hard you hit, it's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward." So recovery from, I was curious, I looked this up, and recovery from hip labrum surgery can take anywhere from 4 months to as many as 9 months, depending on the person. Ciampa is no regular person, he's a pro wrestler, right? Pro wrestlers, they're just built differently, but I don't see him coming back anytime soon. I think he's done for the year, at the very least, he's done for the year. He may not even be back in time for the Royal Rumble. So here's to a full recovery so that he can come back and we can get that DIY reunion that we need. Billy Corgan was in the news. And he did an interview with the website Metro UK, and he had some things to say about WWE and AEW. He said that he is open to the NWA being used as a developmental program for either promotion. And he did talk about how he has had discussions in the past with Triple H regarding the NWA also possibly airing on the WWE Network. He said it didn't go anywhere, and that was fine. Very, very good discussions, very open and very cool. They certainly liked what I was trying to do, and they've always been cool about what I was doing in the NWA. So I remain optimistic going into the future that there might be some business there to do. There might be economic models where they say, take these 10 talent, let us have an oversight position, you help develop these talents. It would be good for the NWA, it would be good for the WWE. There are lots of opportunities there. I would say the same thing even as it pertains to AEW. AEW has a tremendous amount of talent under contract. Not everybody is able to be on their main shows. There might be opportunities where they want to send those people on a developmental level. I don't need somebody's wrestling vision to align with mine if we can do good business together. And at the same time, I don't need them to agree with everything that I'm doing. And I'm lucky in that when you look at the main roster in WWE, I count some of those people among my friends, and some of those people are people I have worked with. And he also said that he believes WWE might be more open to the idea of working with the NWA, with Triple H now being in charge. He said, you might see a different flexibility with WWE as far as other companies go moving into the future. Certainly my conversations in the past with him would indicate that there is a different degree of openness than maybe there would have been in the regime that was running things before. The idea, and look, of course Billy Corgan would love it. Of course he would. Every promoter would love to have an open working relationship with the two top companies in the country. Everybody is going to want to be Triple H's best friend. But the idea, you know, he says, take these 10 talents and we'll have an oversight position, but we'll let you develop these talents for us. The problem is that WWE already has a developmental system. And no matter what you think of that system and how imperfect it may be, they have their own developmental system that they have built. And his suggestion really only benefits Billy Corgan. He's like, WWE, it benefits WWE. How does it benefit WWE to send talent to Billy Corgan's NWA to hone their craft when WWE wants everybody to hone their craft the way that they do things? They can mold them, they can shape them, they can create them, in some cases create them from scratch if they're not, you know, from the independent scene. They love having control over all of that. You think they're going to cede control of developing talent to Billy Corgan in the NWA? For what purpose? What purpose would that serve? Why do they need the NWA to develop talent? What talent has the NWA developed, I would love to know. I enjoyed watching the show NWA Power pre-pandemic. It was great. I would tune in every week, and then the pandemic happened and they went away for a while, and I just never went back to it. But what talent exactly, I would love to know, pray tell, is the NWA actually developing? The WWE would look at this as some kind of case study and go, boy, we need to be sending our talents down there to Billy. No! No! WWE has all this talent, and without spending any money, they're already developing their own talent. They don't need to enter into a working relationship with somebody like Billy Corgan to develop their talent. I know that Billy would love that, but that is not what WWE needs. Now, as far as AEW is concerned, AEW does not have a formal developmental system the way the WWE does, but I would say the same thing. Do they have so much talent that you can kind of loan them out? Maybe Tony Khan could even say, hey, you pay me this much money, I'll loan you this guy, I'll loan you that guy. Yeah, I guess that could be beneficial to Tony. But again, I am failing to see his vision here of how exactly this benefits either one of these companies. This just sounds very, he's living in a dreamland. That could be a new song maybe he can write, Living in a Dreamland by Billy Corgan. Let's talk about NXT. It was Tag Title Tuesday this week with two pretty good tag team title matches, kicking off with the ladies. Katana Chance and Caden Carter, they retained their women's tag team titles against Nikita Lyons and Zoe Stark. This was the best Nikita Lyons match I've seen so far since she debuted. Zoe is already very polished. She's very good. Carter and Chance, they have really come a long way as a team, which is what happens when you put two people together and keep them together for a long time and don't split them up 2 months later. They did a dusty finish with a match restart to add some drama after Stark pinned Chance on a roll-up. Seemingly, they won the titles, but Chance was not the legal member of her team. Another referee came out to dispute the call. They started over again, this time with Carter and Chance winning with their combination backbreaker 450 splash finish. I know why they did the restart. They wanted to keep Lyons and Stark looking strong. It gives them a chance to run the match back again if they want to, but they are so inconsistent with this. To me, it's just silly. Why doesn't another referee run down to correct other bad decisions? They make bad decisions all the time. Why does it only happen once every blue moon? Does it depend on if they're in the back playing poker? Lucky for Chance and Carter, they caught the referees in between games this week. In the men's tag team title match, Pretty Deadly retained over Idris Inoue and Malik Blade. Inoue and Blade, they're also, I think, coming along nicely as a team. They just need more reps. They just need more experience. This was their first chance to really shine. I thought they made the most of it. Two other teams they featured were the Creed Brothers, who each cut promos on Damon Kemp, coming out of Julius beating him in the ambulance match at Halloween Havoc. Kemp was not physically on the show. Brutus wanted a piece of him, but he popped up on screen and he was very smug and he said he wasn't medically cleared. And so instead they got jumped. At the end of the segment, the Creed Brothers got jumped by Veer and Sangha, dressed up in suits. They attacked the Creed. Sangha was showing some restraint at one point, like he was having doubts about what he was doing. And Veer was yelling at him, telling him, do it, do it. He wanted him to choke slam him, but he wouldn't do it. And so Veer gave the guy the $1 million clothesline. And then Sangha finally chokeslammed the other Creed brother. I like what they did with Sangha there, you know, showing that there's still a shred of humanity in this guy's heart. Because they were really building him up. They were babyfacing him over the last few months. And he was developing more of a personality. You know, I would hate for them to just get away from that and just make them the two sort of, you know, generic monsters. We still don't know what Veer said to him to get them to reunite. Maybe he's blackmailing him. Maybe he's got pictures with him with some of the women. Because Sangha was always hanging out with women on these shows. Remember they did that segment a few months ago with him and Valentina Feroz and her partner, whose name just popped out of my head. But they did that yoga segment. And every time we see Sangha in the back, he's usually hanging out with them. He's hanging out with the ladies. Who knows? Maybe Veer's blackmailing him. Veer's like, man, my career has just gone to shit. I got to find a way to get over here. And he paid a private detective to go, you know, follow his former partner around, take dirty photos. And now he's using this to try to resuscitate his own career. Maybe that's the storyline. They set up a match for TV this Tuesday with R-Truth wrestling Grayson Waller after Truth interrupted his segment with Waller and the new North American champion Wes Lee. Shawn Michaels continues to make use of main roster talents that he basically has at his disposal now. All he's got to do is pick up the phone and call his buddy Paul and say, Paul, I want to use this guy. And it's not a bad thing to have some of these people working with, you know, more experienced vets. They already had Waller work with AJ Styles before. So he'll be working with Truth on TV this week. On that subject, they did an interview with Apollo Crews in the back. And he teased the next direction for him on NXT is going to be the NXT champion, Bron Breakker. Probably Bron Breakker and Apollo Crews is where they're going next, not Carmelo Hayes. When Crews first came back to NXT, he made his intentions clear. He said he wanted to be the NXT champion. He even confronted Bron Breakker in the ring about it. He said, I left NXT way too soon. I still had unfinished business. I had things I wanted to accomplish that I never did. And he said that he envisions that one way or the other, there will come a time where he and Bron Breakker would be making history together. So they're circling back to that now. That should be a great match when it happens. Then we had the Schism. Joe Gacy, Jagger Reed, and Rip Fowler. My God, with these fucking names. And their newest member. They now have a female member of the Schism who unmasked herself to reveal Ava Raine. better known as Simone Johnson, the daughter of The Rock. It was a pretty uneventful reveal. She cut a short promo talking about how the schism gave her a home and a family. Who knows? Maybe I will see something in her that will make this group more appealing to me. There's just nothing interesting about this entire act. You know, Undertaker used to have his own ministry, and I wasn't even a fan of that. Bray Wyatt, he made for a good cult leader. The Gacy stuff, it just doesn't do it for me. But you got to start somewhere. And if you want to make people forget the fact that she's the daughter of the biggest Hollywood star in the world, this is one way to do it. I would also mention that she is already, she's 21 years old now. The Rock's daughter is 21 years old. She has already had 3 knee operations, all before her 20th birthday. I'm more interested to see if she can just stay healthy, or if she's going to be plagued by knee issues. You know, the last operation that she had, she said that she was happy to finally not have her knee pop out on her anymore. So maybe whatever the issue was, the last surgery took care of it. Maybe it's not a problem anymore. Because to have 3 knee surgeries by your 19th birthday, that's not good. What kind of personality does she bring to this boring group, and what can she do in the ring? Those are the 2 things I'm going to be looking for. But as far as her debut and her first appearance, I didn't really think it was anything special. But again, it gives her something to do now. It gets her on TV, and now we'll see, you know, what her strengths and what her weaknesses are. But that to me is the biggest thing to watch for. Can she stay healthy? And there was an excellent main event with JD McDonagh beating Ilya Dragunov by ref stoppage with a reverse crossface. The sight of Dragunov with blood coming out of his mouth as McDonagh refused to let go, I thought that was great. McDonagh has failed to beat Bron Breakker twice now, so this was a nice little rebound win for him. But you take 2 NXT UK headliners and you stick them in the main event, you know you're going to get a great main event out of it, and that's what we had on Tuesday. One final NXT-related note, per Mike Johnson of PW Insider, Dominik Dijakovic has officially been shifted over to the NXT brand. We already knew that from the teasers that they've been airing, you know, showing him dropping his Retribution mask into this giant bonfire. But the news here is that they have him listed internally under his old Ring of Honor name of Donovan Dijak. It would surprise me if they stick with the Dijak name, because they still have their policy of not using people's real names, even under Triple H. In some cases, it just doesn't sound like that policy is going to change. But that is where things currently stand. I still call him Donovan Dijak anyway, just because Dominik Dijakovic is a fucking mouthful. So I'd be very happy if he's Donovan Dijak, but very surprised. This week's Tales from the Territories episode on Vice covered championship wrestling from Florida, Bloodstains in the Everglades, run by Eddie Graham, who during his wrestling career was kayfabe, the brother of Dr. Jerry Graham, who was Vince McMahon's favorite wrestler when Vince was a teenager. The same Jerry Graham who once kidnapped his dead mother's corpse right out of the hospital. But that's for a Dark Side of the Ring episode in the future. We got Steve Kern, Kevin Sullivan, Bob Roop, Brian Blair, and Jerry Briscoe as the roundtable for this episode. Roop was kind of quiet. Kern was great, though, telling his stories. A lot of big names came through that Florida territory. Dusty Rhodes, the Briscoes, and a very young, very green Hulk Hogan. And Briscoe told the story of the big guy with the blonde hair who would come to the show every Tuesday night. He was in a local rock band. This guy named Terry Bollea. They got him linked up with Hiro Matsuda to train him. Hogan was fighting back a little bit in the training session, which is when Matsuda, as the story goes, broke Hogan's ankle on purpose. And back then, they would do everything they could to run you out of the business. And if you came back, then they knew, okay, this guy is serious about it. A lot of guys didn't come back. Hogan did. And Jack and Jerry Briscoe, they helped Hogan out of the ring because they were there that day. They heard, you know, Jerry said, "We heard the crack, you know, when Matsuda wrenched down on the ankle." So they helped him out of the ring. They looked down. They saw how black and how swollen his ankle was. They figured that was the end of this guy. But he claimed that Hogan called every day after that asking when he could come back and train. And eventually he did come back. Sullivan posed the question, what if Hogan never came back? Would the business be what it is today if Hulk Hogan had said, fuck this, I don't need this, I'm not coming back, would the business be what it is today? I think the answer is yes. If it wasn't Hogan and Vince wanted the all-American babyface, he probably would have gone with Sergeant Slaughter. He would have overlooked the whole G.I. Joe deal, which is what led to their falling out. Maybe they don't do that first WrestleMania because, you know, had they done it and failed, the company probably would have gone belly up. So maybe they don't, you know, blow it up as big as they did with all the celebrities and everything. But Vince McMahon had the television slots locked down in all of these different... I mean, he was going market by market with a briefcase full of cash, paying to have them play his tapes and not play the other promotions. Like, he had TV slots locked down in all these different markets. I think he would have expanded nationally. It just would have been a lot slower without Hogan. But what I found the most fascinating about the episode was hearing Steve Kern tell the story about his father being captured two different times as a POW. I did not know about any of this. His father is one of only two Americans to be held as a prisoner of war in World War II and the war in Vietnam. You talk about bad luck. Being captured once is bad enough, but twice. They didn't get into the details in the episode, so I did some research myself. He got shot down in his first mission during World War II. Very first mission, he got shot down. His parachute opened, but he hit the ground so hard he snapped both of his ankles. And he was held for a year as a POW in Nazi Germany. And then 20 years later, he got shot down in Vietnam, and they told his family there were no survivors in the crash. And for a year, he thought his father was dead. Until one day, they see this photo of him being marched through the streets of Hanoi. 8 years he was held and tortured there. And there's a great still shot of him running up to his father and giving him a big old bear hug when he finally flew back home and was on the tarmac and he was getting off the airplane. It's just an amazing story. Eddie Graham, he said, in some ways helped fill the void left by his father in those years, you know, that his father was missing. Eddie kind of took him under his wing. But out of this came one of the hottest angles in the territory, which involved Bob Roop, who is a former army man himself, calling Kern's father a disgrace for being captured. Where have I heard that one before? But this whole angle was Kern's idea. Once he checked with his father first to make sure his dad was okay with it, and his father's attitude was, look, anything to help my son's career. He was fine with it. He said Eddie Graham never would have gone for it if he was around, because it was too serious of an angle. But Eddie was away in Australia at the time. He had gone to Australia for a few months. He was trying to buy the territory down there, which ended up not happening, and the promotion down there went out of business. But Bob Roop got a dangerous amount of heat for the angle. He said he tried to stay out of public for 6 months after that. Unless he was going to work, he tried to stay out of public for 6 months. And he told the story one day there was a guy in military, I don't know if it was fatigues or whatever, but a military guy pulled a gun on him, I think at a parking lot. And he said, as he was standing there with his gun pointed at his face, he said, well, I'm not going to attack the guy, because if I reach for him, he'll probably shoot me. And I'm not going to beg for my life, I guess because he has too much pride. So he said, I'm going to turn around and walk away. And that's what he did. He turned his back, and he walked away, hoping that if this guy is a military man, he's not going to shoot me in the back. And he didn't shoot him in the back. They covered the Army of Darkness stuff with Kevin Sullivan, who started out as a babyface and then he turned to this satanic character to play into the whole satanic panic of the 80s. You know, even in the 90s, I got into Dungeons and Dragons for like a hot minute. And I remember there being a lot of controversy around the game and parents thinking that it was going to turn their kids into devil worshippers. I guess my mother wasn't worried because she knew she raised a relatively well-adjusted human being who wasn't going to suddenly grow fucking horns out of his head by playing a game. I'm very grateful I had the parents I did for the time I had them on this earth. I never took that for granted because there's a lot of screwed up people in this country, let me tell you. I consider myself one of the lucky ones. But Sullivan told the story that, you know, 1 week, it was him and it was Blackjack Mulligan. And this was an angle that Dusty Rhodes booked. They called this story the 1 week fight. Dusty Rhodes booked the angle involving him and Blackjack, where they would start fighting on the floor one night, and they fought into the lobby, and the fight went outside into the streets, and the fans are following them until the cops kind of force them back inside. They force the fans back inside. A week later, here comes Sullivan and Mulligan brawling back down to the ring in the same clothes the people saw them in last time. They're all dirty and everything, as if they had been fighting for the entire week. Because this wasn't televised or anything. This is just for the live crowd. And they, the last time they saw them, they were fighting out into the streets. And so here they come back again. That's why they call this the one-week fight. Brian Blair told a ribbing story, because you can't have one of these episodes with at least one rib, that involved Pat Patterson and Pat's longtime partner, Louie Dundaro. The two of them were together for like 40 years until Louie passed away in 98. Actually, Louie died the same night. He had his heart attack, I think, the same night that Undertaker and Mankind had their Hell in a Cell match at the King of the Ring. But anyway, in this story, there's Patterson's car driving beside theirs. They look up and they see Louie mooning them. And so Jack and Jerry Briscoe, they're in the car with Brian Blair, and they tell Blair, who was probably the rookie at the time, you know, we got to get these guys back. So they got Blair to hide in the trunk of the car. Climbing into the trunk was a rookie mistake on his part. But he went along with it because he wanted to be accepted as one of the boys. And the plan was for him to pop out of the trunk at just the right moment and moon Patterson's car. But when Blair popped out of the trunk, they had parked next to the window of a local restaurant. And he ended up with his ass hanging out and his pants around his ankles and a bunch of people and families and kids. They're getting a show that they never asked for. I mean, these people were eating food, for God's sake, and this is what they have to see. So then to make it worse, the Briscoes, they drive off, and they left Blair all by himself. And on the next TV, I guess the story got around, because on the next TV, Gordon Solie, right, who was the voice of championship wrestling from Florida, Gordon Solie said, "The people of Yeehaw Junction would like to thank Brian Blair for his public appearance." Then things got dark in the episode, a little dark. They didn't go too dark. I'll go darker here in a second, but they got dark when they talked about Eddie Graham's downfall. Eddie Graham had been a recovering alcoholic. He had not had a drink in 13 years. And when he was sober, they said he was fine to deal with. But when he drank, he was a lunatic. And he started drinking again. He had, I think, it, oh God, who was it? Was it? It was Brian Blair and Steve Kern, maybe. They were on Eddie's boat with Eddie. And they were doing this thing with beer cans where they like cut a hole in it and were holding it upside down so that the beer goes down your throat faster. Anyway, Eddie saw them doing this and said, "Let me try that." And that's what, I guess, knocked him off the wagon. He started drinking again. And they said it was just a steady progression from there, including one last crazy story in the episode here of him piloting his plane while drunk off of his ass through the nightly Disney World fireworks display, because they were in Florida. And every night, Disney World, they have this big, giant pyro display. He drove his plane through the fire, not over it, through the fireworks display. And Kern was on the flight with him. He was scared out of his mind that they were going to go down, they were going to get blown up. Somehow they made it out alive, but Graham was just a mess. And in the end, they were all very sad that Eddie, you know, he lost everybody around him. They all left the territory. All the big stars, they all just went elsewhere. Most of his talent left for the Carolinas. They didn't get into how Eddie died or any of the tragedy with the family. But at the end of his life, the persistent rumor has been that he got involved in some sort of illegal land deal gone wrong. And he was very worried, not only about the money that he lost and apparently had to come up with, which was said to be somewhere around $500,000, but he was worried that if it came out, his reputation as this pillar in the community down in Florida would just be shattered, and he could wind up behind bars. But take your pick. I mean, there's been lots of theories about what caused or contributed to his suicide. It could have been that. It could have been the depression. It could have been his drinking. He had a lot of problems. But in January of 85, I think it might have been on Super Bowl Sunday, he shot and killed himself at home. Not before calling his son Mike to tell him that he loved him. And then he shot himself in the head. Fast forward to 2010. Okay, that was 1985. Fast forward to 2010. Mike's son, Stephen, killed himself the exact same way. Just 37 years old. Shot himself in the head. And his friends said that Mike, you know, Mike Graham, he never got over that. And then 2 years later, Mike Graham died the exact same way. Took his own life with a gunshot to the head. Not only that, but according to Kevin Sullivan, Eddie's father, so that would be Mike's grandfather, also committed suicide. And Eddie had a brother who I guess had terminal cancer, and he also killed himself. So when you think of tragic wrestling families and people taking their own lives, you think of the Von Erichs, right? The Von Erichs are the poster children for that. But the Grahams are right up there with them. So it got a little bit dark there at the end, but overall, I thought it was another enjoyable episode. This Tuesday, it is the Stampede Wrestling episode, and they got Bret Hart for the roundtable. So I can't wait to hear how Bret blames Bill Goldberg for the downfall of the Stampede territory. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. The mail delivery today, I mean, look at it, these letters are just overflowing out of my sack. So I will reach into my sack and I will feel around, and I have a letter here from Andrew from Birmingham, England. I have been watching AEW for all of 2022 and probably caught one or two episodes of WWE. I don't have time to watch both products and I just want to watch the best wrestling content that I can. I did judge that to be AEW because I got sick of WWE. But I've been questioning recently if that is still AEW or is it now WWE with Triple H now in charge. So I was wondering, as this year is coming to a close, if you were tied to only one company, or rather he says, if you were tied to only watching either Raw and SmackDown or Rampage and Dynamite for 2023, which would you choose and why? Oh, I would mix them up. I would choose Dynamite and SmackDown. I would take a little bit of ball. I'd take a little bit from here. I'd take a little bit from there. I'd go Dynamite and SmackDown. If you limited me to only one company and I had to choose between Dynamite and Rampage or Raw and SmackDown, I'm going to choose Raw and SmackDown. Raw and SmackDown are still the two biggest shows of the week. Raw and SmackDown are still the two shows that people want to hear the most about. And beyond just the, a podcaster's choice as far as what I think people want to hear me talk about, I just think in terms of overall enjoyment, I probably would go with Raw and SmackDown. So, yeah, I mean, if you put me in a position where I had to make a decision one way or the other, I'm going to go with WWE. But if you gave me the choice, I'd like to mix them up a little bit. I'd go Dynamite and SmackDown. Tony from Los Angeles, I know you hate 3-hour Raws, but do you think there is a possibility that during the TV contract negotiations that Triple H could negotiate something with USA Network where he can split the hours and do 2 hours of Raw on Monday and give them the other hour on Thursday instead as a brand new show? Kind of like how Tony Khan negotiated Dynamite to be kept at 2 hours to make Rampage 1 hour on Fridays when TNT wanted Dynamite to be 3 hours. I don't know where you got that from. That's the first I'm hearing that they wanted Dynamite to be 3 hours. I got news for you. If Warner wanted Dynamite to be 3 hours, then Dynamite would be 3 hours. So again, I have no idea where you heard that. I have no idea where you got that from. That is not true, as far as I know. And as far as splitting up the Raw program, having 2 hours on Monday and 1 hour on another night, I don't really like that idea. I just don't like the idea of them having shows on every fucking night of the week, or practically every night of the week. I would just rather Raw goes back to 2 hours. And, you know, that's it. But that's, again, the perfect world scenario. That's not going to happen. The network wants the third hour. I assume they're paying WWE well for that third hour. And that's just the way it's going to be. Triple H can certainly say to them, look, you know, can we work something out where we take the show back to 2 hours? I just think it's baked into the cake at this point. You know, they've been doing these 3-hour shows for 10 years. 10 years. USA, by all accounts, is pretty happy with the numbers that Raw's been putting up recently. And so do you really expect USA Network is going to turn around and say, yeah, we'll let you take Raw back to 2 hours. We'll figure something else out. We'll put some kind of movie of the week on or something in the other spot, you know, the other slot. I don't see that happening. You're also assuming that they're going to stick with USA. I think they will. They've had a relationship with USA for so long. But it's always possible that they go somewhere else, you know, or they get some kind of streaming deal. I mean, look at this. We've got baseball games now on Apple Plus and things on Amazon Prime, and who knows, you know, all it takes is one of the big streamers to offer WWE a boatload of cash, and all of a sudden they're off cable, and they're on one of the streaming services. I would not make any assumptions that they're going to be staying with USA Network. I think it's very likely they will. I think they have that relationship with NBC Universal, right? They sold the network to Peacock for 5 years. I don't think they're going to go anywhere, but nothing is guaranteed. Except all that TV money that they're getting from these companies. That's about the only thing that's guaranteed. That's why they can sit high on their perch and smile, because they know they have all this guaranteed money coming in. Ty from DC. My question is about Vince McMahon in storyline firing Paul Heyman on Raw back in November of 2001. I know Jerry Lawler returned that same night, and everything that happened with him being out was because you've talked about it in the past, but what was the deal with Heyman? Was the firing legit? Was he working backstage after the King returned, or were WWE keeping him on ice to reintroduce him to the audience with Brock Lesnar as his client later the next year? No, I mean, he wasn't fired. They had planned to take Heyman and Shane McMahon off television after Survivor Series to sell the stipulation. Once Team WWF beat the Alliance, that was the end of the invasion. Heyman and Shane and Stephanie were all a very big part. They were leading the invasion. They were leading the invaders. So to sell the storyline, it didn't make any sense to keep them around. So they fired Heyman on television, and they got Lawler back as well. And once they got Lawler back, they didn't need Heyman in the spot with Jim Ross anymore. So they didn't fire him. He worked strictly as a writer behind the scenes. And as far as when the idea popped up to have him manage Lesnar, I would imagine it was something that probably came up not too long before it happened. I don't think when they fired him on TV in November that they knew they were going to reintroduce him as a manager for Brock. But he was working as a writer behind the scenes. Miles from Dallas. If you had a time machine and could travel back in time to watch one match and one pay-per-view live in attendance, what would that match and that pay-per-view be? He says, for me, the match would be Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker in Houston at WrestleMania 25. The pay-per-view would be WrestleMania 18 in Toronto. Also, if you are Tony Khan and the plan is to buy out CM Punk's contract, but Punk pitches the idea to put MJF over in a career versus title match, would you do it? I'll answer the last question first. No. If he wants to get rid of CM Punk, you get rid of CM Punk. It's too much of a risk. So the answer is no. Now to the other question. One match and one pay-per-view to watch live. The match would be Rock and Hogan at WrestleMania 18 at the Sky Dome. The pay-per-view would be the first one-night stand show at the Hammerstein Ballroom. I still to this day regret not going to that show. It was right in my backyard, and I didn't go to the show. I still kick myself for it. Jordan from Washington, D.C. I wanted to know, if you were a pro wrestler, whose career would you rather have had, Chris Jericho or Kurt Angle? Jericho has obviously had the longer run, but I think most agree that Kurt shined brighter when you compare both of their primes. Jericho. I would go with Jericho. I mean, Kurt beat his body to shit. Jericho works smarter. But you look at all the things Jericho has done across multiple promotions, I'm sure he's made more money than Kurt Angle has. And even now, to be able to go out there and do what he does at 50 or 51, whatever he is now, is very impressive. And Jericho now in AEW gets to basically call his own shots and work with whoever he wants to work with. You know, Jericho's had one of the more charmed careers in the history of the business. I would want to be Jericho. And I also wanted to always be in a rock band. I don't know what I would call my rock band, but I think I would grow my hair out, hit the road. What a life, right? What a life to live. Solomonster drinking Grey Goose out of the bottle on his tour bus as he goes from city to city. Solomonster and his Solomon stars. Julius from the Bronx. I recently found out that Masahiro Chono has the record for the most G1 Climax tournament wins. I also found out that he was the first G1 winner. Do you think that there is anybody in New Japan right now that could beat Chono's record at some point? Yes. His name is Okada. Chono has 5, Okada has 4. Okada will at least tie him before he is done. Daniel from Hamburg, what was the bigger draw and overall deal? I'm sorry, who? Who was the overall bigger draw and deal during their run in their respective companies? Randy Savage in WCW or CM Punk in AEW? I'm inclined to say Punk in AEW. The thing is, though, Savage had a longer run in WCW. And Savage was just Randy Savage is just a bigger star than CM Punk is. So, but we're not talking, that's not the question he's asking. As far as, you know, relative to the promotion, Hogan was always a much bigger deal to WCW and to WWE than Savage was. I know Macho Man fans don't like to hear that, but that's just the way it is. Savage was always playing second fiddle to Hogan. So Savage meant something to WCW because he was another big name from Vince McMahon that they got to come over. And to be able to have the 1-2 punch of Hogan and Savage was a very big deal for WCW. Did Savage have the kind of impact on WCW's business, though, that CM Punk did on AEW's business? You know, when I talked about Punk earlier in the podcast, I said, you know, he can directly link him to a couple of million-dollar gates. I think the first million-dollar gates that the company had in 5 of their best pay-per-views. If you were to look at the numbers, and I don't have them in front of me, but if you were to look at them, I don't think that you would see a direct line from Randy Savage to any of those big sort of financial business milestones that WCW experienced when they were really firing on all cylinders. You would trace it back to Hogan and the NWO, and that came in 96 and 97. Sting, Goldberg got hot. I wouldn't directly link those to Randy Savage, though. You know, Savage came in the end of 94, beginning of 95. I'd have to go back and see how those pay-per-views did, you know, especially if Savage headlined any that Hogan wasn't on, but I don't think that he meant to WCW's business what Punk did to AEW. I really don't. As far as who was a bigger deal, again, I think I would go with Punk in AEW. I think to those fans, and part of it was him being away for so long. Savage left WWE a month later. He was on WCW television, you know, or 2 months later, whatever it was. It's just two different situations. I just think Punk was a bigger deal to the AEW fans, and I think AEW as a company, than Savage was to WCW. William from Calgary. We'll end with this. Who is the greatest special attraction WWE wrestler of all time? Andre the Giant or The Undertaker? Putting WWE in there is a very important caveat, because if we're talking wrestling in general, the answer is Andre. We're not even talking in-ring per se, but just as a draw, as an attraction, Andre far eclipses The Undertaker. I get that there's going to be a recency bias for a lot of people when it comes to Undertaker. A lot of people listening to this probably weren't even alive when Andre was in his prime as a draw. But Andre was the definition of a special attraction. He worked all over the place, multiple territories, multiple promotions, multiple countries, multiple continents. In WWE specifically, Undertaker had a bigger run than Andre did because of his longevity. So if we're talking WWE, greatest special attraction wrestler, I gotta go Undertaker. But if we're talking just wrestling in general, it's not even close. The answer is Andre. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster is the place to go on there. YouTube, of course. We have a lot of content coming up in the month of November. We are heading into what should be the biggest month of the entire year. It's going to be a very busy time. 3 different pay-per-views. We have 2 watch-alongs coming along soon. 1 for Montreal on November 9th. And then 20-year anniversary coming up with the very first Elimination Chamber match at Survivor Series. all the weekly streams, Raw, Dynamite, SmackDown. We have a lot of shit coming up. So I want you guys to head over to the YouTube channel. I want you to hit the subscribe button. And I want you to make sure that notification bell is turned on. So that way when new content goes up or I'm going live, you will get a notification that, hey, Solid Monster is going live. So that way you can join me. You can run on in and take a seat, make some popcorn, fix a drink, sit down, watch the stream. So go ahead and subscribe on YouTube as well. And I'm going to be back with you here next Sunday. That's going to be episode 781. I guess technically next weekend. Yeah, well, next weekend is November 6th. Technically, that is the 15-year anniversary. And what I will probably do is what I've done the last couple of years, although 15 is a big one, but I'll probably do a live stream. I don't know what the live stream will entail, if it'll be Q&A, if it'll be, I don't know what it'll be. Maybe it'll be AMA, it'll be a free-for-all, I don't know. We'll do some kind of anniversary stream in a few weeks, but the very first podcast I ever did, and I would have to, actually, let me check right now. I will check my trusty calendar here. I want to say it was November 6th of 2007. It was. How about that? To the day. To the day. November 6th, 2007. Because it was the Tuesday after Raw that week. A very short show. Went 7 minutes. If you are one of our channel members, Legends tier channel members on YouTube, you can actually listen to the first 13 episodes that I ever did. They're up right now. More to come. But it was November 6th of 2007. I recorded the very first sound off for SEScoops.com. It is amazing to think that next weekend is going to be 15 years since that day. That's unbelievable. And I have people listening to this right now who were with me since day one. You guys are the OGs, man. You guys have been hanging with me all this time. I can't express my appreciation enough. So let's celebrate and we'll hang out and we'll do what we do. Episode 781 next Sunday. Until then, be well, stay safe. Have yourself a very happy Halloween. If you have kids, be trick-or-treating. If you don't have kids, go trick-or-treating. What the fuck? Free candy, right? And I'll be back with you next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Be an Austin Theory. He has a beard, like any good heel, right? You gotta have a good beard. That's how you know I'm a babyface. I got no beard. Every other podcaster, they have the fucking rat's nest on their fucking face or the hat or whatever. Like, not me. We're clean cut here, baby. No beard here. White meat baby face. That's what you get here on Solomonster Sounds Off.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
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 Solomonster Sounds Off.